Many moons ago, back in November actually, we were in the Gospel of Mark, and we were in chapter 9, actually, of the Gospel of Mark, the first part of that chapter, and want to pick up in Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 14, with the man who brings his son, who is epileptic and or has demons. The text talks about demons. Some have tried to say that it was a form of epilepsy because all the things that he does here show grand mal seizure characteristics, etc. But here we've got this son and his father who brings his son to first to Jesus' disciples, and they can't do anything. And then Jesus comes up and performs the healing here. But it's also where this particular father says, you know, he's got faith, but, you know, please have pity on us and help us. And so it's really kind of a contrast between the authority of Jesus and Jesus mentions here the unfaithful or unbelieving generation. And it's a matter of belief and faith as opposed to unbelief. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd about them and scribes arguing with them. This is when Jesus and Peter, James, and John have just come off the Mount of Transfiguration that we talked about. That's kind of where we ended last time. And so they're joining the other disciples who got a crowd around them. And evidently it's not a very happy crowd at this particular point. Because the scribes are arguing with them. So we've got the teachers of the law, we've got the lawyers arguing with the disciples. And immediately, there's one of Mark's favorite words again, immediately, all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" And so he wants to know, okay, what's going on here? What are you talking with the religious leaders about who don't have faith in Jesus? And one of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a dumb spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it dashes him down. He foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately, again, it convulsed, and convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked his father, "How long has he had this?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately, again, the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You dumb and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him, bless you, and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house with his disciples, they asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." There's astonishment here, and there's fear as Jesus comes back because of Jesus' authority. People knew his authority had shown before, even before he did anything. People remembered, the disciples may have remembered, when he was in the synagogue and the man with the unclean spirit came in, and immediately the unclean spirit cries out and Jesus says, "Come out, shut up and come out of him." And the spirit is silent. It comes out and people say, "Whoa, a new teaching. Even the demons do what he says." So, you know, they're shocked and they were afraid. We found another place earlier where the people were afraid of what Jesus had done in a healing because they doubted. And so here we've got this. Jesus' authority shows up even before he acts and he speaks. The disciples have had difficulty. We find here that there's been an argument going on. The disciples are trying to cast the demon out of this man, trying to cast the spirit out of this man, and nothing's happening. And so the scribes are arguing with the disciples that are there, the nine. Probably, this is probably a confrontation. You know, they say, well, we thought you were so, you and your master were supposed to be so powerful and so wonderful. Why can't you do this? And so they're doubting this, and I would not be the least bit surprised if we could go back in time and be there for this incident if we wouldn't find the scribes quoting things in the law about witches and magic and Beelzebub and all these kinds of things. So the situation when Jesus arrives is one that's already filled with tension and stress. And so when Jesus arrives, all the crowd, when they saw him, are amazed that he's shown up just at this point. And they run to him, and probably who runs to him here are the disciples and the Father. Not the whole crowd. The crowd's amazed, and there's women, okay, what's going to happen now? Because they know that Jesus and the scribes have already had some conflicts. But the disciples' difficulty is due to a lack of unbelief, Jesus says. Here he mentions that, and then again at the end, when they said in verses 28 and 29, why couldn't we cast this out? And said, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. And that is prayer in conjunction with belief. Now, I know some manuscripts say prayer and fasting, but fasting seems to be a later addition to the text. It generally, in the oldest manuscripts, it ends with prayer. Jesus calling upon them to pray with faith. In fact, Jesus indicates here that they and the crowds are not much different from the teachers of the law who don't have this belief or this faith in Jesus and who question his coming from God. The difference, though, in them is they know where to turn for help. Scribes and the Pharisees refuse to. And Jesus is trying to warn the disciples, among other things here, is, you know where to turn for help, but you need to do it with faith and belief, not unbelief. And so when they run up, Jesus says, okay, I saw what was going on. What were you all discussing? Well, we've already been told by Mark it was an argument. Jesus said, what were you discussing? Which kind of is an attempt to calm the situation a little bit instead of calling it an argument. And one of the men says, that comes up with him, teacher, I brought my son. So we've got this son that's got some kind of spirit going on, some kind of seizures going on, etc. And he said, I came and asked your disciples to cast it out, and they couldn't. They couldn't. Well, I guess they were waiting for Jesus then to immediately do something, but before that, Jesus wants to indicate something about true belief and acting upon that belief and kind of a shallow sense of belief. And he answered them. So he, instead of immediately dealing with this, and this is typical of Jesus in a lot of cases, more so in the Gospel of John than in Mark, Matthew, or Luke, but we do find it occasionally here. Instead of answering the question or dealing with that issue, Jesus gives an aside which kind of teaches and catches them off guard. Instead of saying, okay, well, bring him here, let me heal him, Jesus said, well, I'll tell you what. O faithless generation. So he's calling not just the law guys, the scribes, the lawyers. He's calling his disciples faithless. He's calling his disciples faithless. Now, he's not saying they don't have any faith, but they've got a very shallow faith. They've got a faith that doesn't truly see what's going on and doesn't act upon it properly. O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? I mean, I'm not going to be here all that long. The disciples should speak from true faith rather than argument. And he said, I'm not going to be here with you that long. And he is putting himself as diametrically opposed to them. He said, I'm the one in whom you should have faith because of my faith in the Father and the Father sending me. You shouldn't be out here arguing about these things. You should come in faith. But instead, you are proving yourself to be part of this generation that doesn't understand and doesn't really, they want everything handed without the work of faith. O faithless generation, how long am I to bear with you? Which in this instance, Jesus is also showing some exasperation. How long am I going to have to put up with this kind of stuff from y'all? Yeah. You're not, you're testing, that's right, you're testing my patience. Yeah. How long do I have to put up with you doing this? Bring him to me. And so, you know, he's actually grieving here over their unbelief. In fact, it causes Jesus suffering. That even the disciples are categorized as unfaithful and unbelieving here. I mean, they've been with him for a while now. They've seen what he's done, and they still don't understand the import of his ministry. So he says, bring him to me. They bring the boy, and immediately, as soon as the boy looks on him, I guess, you know, movies, you may or may not have ever seen The Omen, Gregory Peck and all that kind of stuff. And when Damien is in the limo and they're going to the church, to the cathedral, and as soon as the cathedral gets in sight and he starts going crazy in the back seat and kicking and foaming at the mouth and all that kind of stuff, and he only calms down when they drive away. That's kind of the situation here. Only without the limo and without the cathedral. As soon as the boy looks on Jesus, immediately he convulses and falls to the ground, starts foaming at the mouth, kicking around, all that kind of stuff. Jesus said, okay, how long has he been this way? And the man tells him, since childhood. But notice, this also, and Edward Schweizer says, this situation with the demons or with the spirit shows there is not an opportunity for reflection upon Jesus' words when you are confronted with him. When one is confronted with Jesus, they must make a decision then. It's not like, okay, well, this is interesting. Let me go over here and sit down for a while and I'll get back to you. Of course, then again, Mark is writing to a group of people who are under persecution in Rome and who have to make decisions about very quickly. Am I going to stand up or not? Yes.
Jesus told the disciples nobody to believe. And the son of his father spoke up and said, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. That kind of contradictory. Help my unbelief.
Well, he wants Jesus to give a sign and help his son. He says, you know, I believe, but I still got some doubt. Can you help bolster my belief? You know, have you ever been in a situation where, you know, you said, oh, Lord, I know you're here and you're gonna help the situation, but in the back of your mind you're thinking, I hope you're going to help this situation. Yeah. Or, you know, it seems hopeless. How can you help? You know, and you say, show me.
Yeah. Yeah.
From childhood, yeah, the father has doubts. I'm sure this good Jewish father had been praying to God and doing all kinds of sacrifices and everything else for his child's life. And so he says, you know, help my unbelief. In other words, help me to really grasp hold of this, bolster. You know, and Schweizer, who actually is a Lutheran, I think he's still alive. But if he is, he's in his 90s now. But Schweizer sees this in some ways, I think, as you've got a certain amount of belief, but belief, the strength for that belief is not totally upon you. It's something that God helps to support and God helps to give. It's not a predestinarian kind of thing, but it's something that you have to rely on God and recognize that all power comes from God ultimately. And if you don't tap into that, then you're not going to ever have that situation where you can fully believe and have that kind of faith. So, you know, they meet Jesus, they do this, he says, from childhood, in fact, he's almost died a bunch of times. He does this and he goes in the fire, he goes in the water, and wherever, and just comes on him unexpectedly. And he says, so, if you can do anything, and that's part of his doubt, where he eventually says, well, help, I believe in you, but I'm not quite sure, so help my unbelief. Help my unbelief by helping my son. But notice he says, if you can do something, which then raises the question around in the crowd. And I know that there are some scholars, I don't agree with them, but that's okay. There's some scholars who think that with this demon in the son, that this is the influence of that demon. Because what is in the temptations? the three in the Bible, not the five from Motown, and the temptations. What does the tempter say every time? If you are the Son of God, do this. If you are the Son of God, jump off the temple. If you are the Son of God. And here this man says, if you can do anything. That it's, there's some who think the demon was influencing the man and trying to get cast doubt in Jesus' own mind as to whether he could do it or not. I don't agree, but that's their opinion. That's okay. And so here he says, if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us. And it is us. Yes, he wants his son healed. He wants pity on his son. But at the same time, think, as Sarah said, think about how long this has been going on, and this man's had to put up with it and watch his son suffer, and it'll be a relief for him. It'll be help for him if Jesus can heal the son and he doesn't have to worry about this anymore. Yes, Rob.
Also, the disciples have tried to do it, and they couldn't do it, so that was more unbelief.
Right. It bolsters unbelief, because that's why the scribes were arguing with them. Say, oh, I thought y'all were so special, and your master was so special, and you can't do this? He's not that special.
Yeah, but when God told the disciples and everything, he said, believe in prayer.
Yeah. Well, the presumption here is that they did not sincerely pray for help. They just went about and tried to do it. Abracadabra, hocus pocus, whatever, and it didn't do it. Yeah.
The human coming out.
That's right, and they couldn't. And they couldn't. And Jesus, yes?
It also begs the question of if it's God's will.
Yeah,
I mean, is it God's will that everybody that's sick is healed? Everybody that comes to be healed is
ultimately healing, yes, but not necessarily immediate healing.
You know, as I hear that, I think.
Yeah.
That just begs the question for me.
It does raise a question. And for this man, it's raised a serious question. And what he's doing, he's really putting Jesus on the spot as well.
What I've always said about when you pray for somebody, you say, your will be done.
Yeah.
You know,
and
be careful what you pray for.
Well, yeah. And you hope that God's, but yeah. Oftentimes when they do that, just like this man, if he were praying this prayer, when he's asking Jesus, in a way he is, almost praying and saying, you know, if you can't help us, you know, he's saying, I want your will, I want my will to be your will. Instead of your will to be my will. But I understand the human part of it with his child, too. And all of that. But yeah, I do understand, because we don't.
There are some things, aren't there, that can't be fixed? I mean, like a person who doesn't have a hand, you pray with all your might and faith that he'll have a hand, but there's not going to be a hand there.
Not a real hand. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Some things people pray for that can't be, no matter how much you're paying.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I think that.
I mean, blindness sometimes,
yeah,
you could say.
Well, it's like you said in Sunday school this morning, the woman that Helen Keller
couldn't do anything. She had to with her teeth.
Johnny Erickson.
Yeah, but don't some people, though, if you don't have sight, then he increases your hearing.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I've said that if you can't have it that way, it can come to you in that
right.
way. For example, the person who may be infertile who can't bear children, there's just no way that can ever be fixed. They can still be a mother
right.
and maybe adopt a child.
Right, that's true.
Have something like that. But still, if you're praying for God to fix that, that might not be fixable.
Well, it may not be, and we have plenty of examples in the Old Testament where that women were barren and you know, Sarah was barren. Rebecca was barren. Yeah, on and on you go. Hannah was barren. Elizabeth was barren. Of course, she wasn't praying at that point, but we don't know how long she had, only to have those hopes squashed, and then there was a miraculous intervention. There's nothing outside the scope of God, but sometimes we expect too much of what we want immediately from God. And so, there are some things that the only fix may be something that we're not thinking of. It's something that God has in mind otherwise.
I think the best thing to do is pray for strength to endure the situation.
What right.
Put it in his hands, so to speak, and guide him through the hard times.
Yeah.
Tell me what to do to make it easier.
Yeah, that's true, Ed. And here, when Jesus says, answer, if you can, All things are possible to him who believes. Jesus is talking about his faith, not the man's faith. Jesus is talking about his own faith, as opposed to the faith of the man and the disciples and the scribes and the crowd in general, who have a superficial faith. So there's contrast between true faith and superficial faith here. Schweizer says that only in the knowledge of his unbelief can one truly acknowledge the divine gift of faith joyfully and with assurance that God will give it. End quote. That's a recognition that ultimately it's not just us. There's a component that has to come from God. And so immediately the father says, I believe, but help my unbelief. And when Jesus saw the crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit. Now, came running together can be interpreted two different ways. One is Jesus sees the crowd rushing up to look and see what's about to happen, and he does it. There's another way that this can be seen as the crowd is rushing up upon Jesus, possibly to either push him out of the way or to try and force Jesus to do something. And so he preemptively strikes here. He rebukes the unclean spirit, commands him to come out and never enter again. But notice, while it says immediately, it's not poof and the little boy says, hi, everything's wonderful. There is probably and when it says, and after crying out and convulsing him terribly, the Greek phrase there to convulse him terribly is basically means it's the worst fit he has ever had. It strikes fear in the hearts of everybody around. It's the worst fit he's ever had. And when he finally stops convulsing, you can't even tell he's breathing. And everybody says he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. This is a preview of the resurrection, by the way. When it says, and Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. That's kind of a preview of God the Father lifts him up and he arose in the resurrection. Remember, Mark's writing this after the fact. Many, many years after the fact. Over 35 years after the fact that he's writing this. And he's writing it to a church that's beginning to wonder in the midst of all this persecution under Nero, beginning to wonder, is there any hope? Their belief and their faith is being questioned and tested severely. That's why the way he writes, Mark writes, it's intentional to try and capture the urgency in Jesus' ministry for some and the urgency in what his readers are experiencing and say, look, it was urgent here. That's why he uses immediately so much. Because immediately gives you that sense of got to hurry up, urgency. Right? And so he's doing this here. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately. So now he gets away from the crowd. Everybody's astonished. They're looking at this boy. They're congratulating the father. Some of them are still kind of, I'm not too sure about this. So Jesus takes the opportunity to leave with the disciples and go into a nearby house to instruct them a little more, to answer their question. Because really, when they said, when he said, your disciples weren't able to do this, Jesus knows their questioning in their hearts. Why can't we do it? And they asked him, why could we not cast that out? And Jesus said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. He gives a call to prayer, not only as evidence for faith and belief, but as a foundation for faith and belief. Jesus links prayer and faith, prayer and belief together. Prayer is the foundation to bolster belief, but prayer is also to go to prayer for this kind of thing is also evidence of true faith and true belief. When Jesus raises Lazarus, what does he say out loud? he prays and he says, Father, I thank you for hearing my prayer. I know that you always hear my prayers, but I am praying this aloud so that those around may believe that you have sent me. Schweizer says, and I quote, perhaps the truth that all power is found in God and not in the inner being of the believer is stressed more emphatically by Jesus' call to prayer than for his call to faith. End of quote. That the recognition of God's power and the effectiveness of God's power and the ability of God's power as opposed to our own ability is better seen in a call to prayer. And so while the crowd is dispersing, Jesus and his disciples leave. Don't know if it's clandestine leaving or if they just kind of go. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he would have nobody know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. I mean, they've seen what's happened over here. Now they're afraid to ask him because they're afraid they're going to be rebuked again. The reason Jesus withdraws from the public at this particular point in time is part of Mark's messianic secret motif. But at this particular point of time is that he still doesn't want public fame. Even though he heals this boy in front of all these people, he doesn't want to be invited to play Caesar's palace as just another miracle worker. And he wants the opportunity to teach the disciples that he's more than just a miracle worker. Why did the man come to Jesus' disciples? I need a miracle for my son. They can't do anything. He comes to Jesus. I need a miracle for my son. Jesus gets followed by crowd after crowd after crowd, primarily, and especially in the first part of the Gospel of Mark, people bring him. He can't even enter a town openly, and people bring all kinds of folks with diseases for him to heal. Now, it's not a bad thing that he heals those folk. But they do that, and then the implication is they bring folks to be healed, and then they turn around, they leave, and they tell people, well, if you need a miracle, go see Jesus. Yeah, and supposed miracle workers were a denarius a dozen, or maybe a temple shekel a dozen. It's kind of like all these, we used to talk about Oral Roberts and Catherine Kuhlman. I still remember watching Catherine Kuhlman on TV sometimes on Sunday morning. Catherine Kuhlman was kind of the female counterpart to Oral Roberts and Helmet Head. Benny Hinn. And those kinds of things. You know, and Jesus didn't want to be seen as that kind of person, because his ministry was greater than that. And actually, if that was the primary reason that he was out there and the people came to him and then they go on about their business, oh, you need a miracle, go see Jesus. That actually would belittle the particular reason that he came. So he wants to get away from that, and he also wants to teach his disciples that the true revelation of God is that the Son of Man has come here to die and rise for them. His path leads to the suffering of the Son of Man. What they want and what these crowds want is to keep him around for a show. Come to the show or come to the carnival or whatever. So they travel through Galilee, part of Galilee, and they come to Capernaum, which is the fishing village, of course, where Peter, James, and John are from. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, don't know for sure, many scholars think that this house was probably the house of Simon Peter or Andrew. Although if they've left the wives for this long, I'm not so sure they'd let them back in. But and left the kids. But they go to a house, but they're on their way. We're not told this until Jesus asks the question. He says, okay, what were y'all talking about on the road? But they were silent. Why? Because they were talking about who's going to be the greatest one. I mean, they're in Jesus' presence, and they won't talk about who's the greatest one among them. They were silent. For on the way, they discussed with one another who was the greatest. But Jesus knew what they were talking about. Yeah. He'd been eavesdropping. He knew what they were talking about.
Did they realize all of their goodness after Jesus' sins, how bad they were?
In the Gospel of Mark, Mark tends to paint the picture of the disciples as rather inept and bumbling and dense. So, and they're kind of inept and bumbling and dense. And here, they're talking about, okay, we're following him. Now, who's going to be his right-hand man? And who's going to come second? You know, and they're trying to rank things in a hierarchy. Because after all, within Judaism, within organizations, we set a hierarchy, don't we? We generally have a hierarchy. And so, and within Judaism, you had the high priest, and then you had his lieutenants, and then you had others under them. In actuality, the development, as the church developed, the development of the Episcopal form of government, which is not just the Episcopal church, but the primary example is the Roman Catholic Church, where the authority at the top down was based on Judaism, the authority at the top down. The high priest down. And so they've been talking about, well, who's going to be number one? And who's going to be number two? And this kind of stuff. Basically, they're blind. They're ignorant to the real meaning of Jesus' career. And so they're afraid to tell him what they're talking about. But Jesus already knows. One commentator says, and I quote, "Man's intense longing for greatness, expressed especially in his inferiority complex, shows that he is separated from God because God in Jesus affirms lowliness. And in fact, he himself can be lowly too." End of quote. God lowers himself to be one of us in Jesus. Elevating the lowly, not the rich and famous. That kind of stuff. And so he says he already knew what they were talking about. And he sat down and called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone would be first," and they're thinking, okay, who's he going to pick? Who's he going to pick? "He must be last of all and servant of all." He was saying, you know, in the sight of God, you know, there's a difference in rank when it comes to you and when it comes to God. In the sight of God, it is the one who is last and servant of all that is in higher estimation than anyone else. And he draws and takes a child to him and put him in the middle of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Here, child is, he takes the child. What are characteristics of children?
Dependent.
They're helpless, they're dependent. They're helpless on their own, they're weak on their own, they're trusting, those kinds of things. So the child here is illustrative of the helplessness and the trust of little ones with whom Jesus identifies. But it's also a portrait, by the way, child here and little ones in verses 42 and following have been misinterpreted for centuries. He's actually talking about the disciples. A true disciple and true discipleship means you must be needy like the child, needy for God and trusting in God and Jesus like the child. And when he says in verse 42, "Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin," he's not talking about children. He's talking about those who would be disciples. Those who would be disciples. This is an impression upon the disciples that Jesus and even the Father will be found in the little ones, those who have faith like a child, those who are trusting like a child, those who lean upon, need that dependency, recognize the dependency they need. And he says, whoever does that, it's not just receiving me. They're receiving my Father who sent me. And they'll be acceptable to God, is what he's saying. Verse 38 and following, this is the only place in the Gospel of Mark that John has any significant role. John the disciple. And John then said to him, well, teacher, we saw a man casting out demons in your name. Now, Jesus has just said, first has to be last. And he's just said, you got to be trusting and helpless like this child. And John speaks up and says, but, you know, we saw this guy casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he wasn't following us. But Jesus said, do not forbid him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon after to speak evil of me, for he that is not against us is for us. Truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose his reward. John here embodies our natural tendencies, does he not? I mean, you want people on your team that are exactly like you, right? Or that think like you. Even in the church, where we're concerned sometimes with winning members and strengthening our own church group with numbers. And those who sit on the fence and those who don't join with us, we don't have a whole lot of patience with, do we? Even in the church, we don't. Even in other religions, they don't. Don't join up, we're going to kill you. But then again, we did that some in the Middle Ages too. Don't join up, we're going to kill you. Jesus' response here shows that if one truly believes enough to do things in Jesus' name, then that person will not be able to despise Jesus or talk bad about Jesus. If he's truly doing it in Jesus' name, that means he's got faith. In contrast to the unbelieving generation. Who tried to do but couldn't. Why? Because they hadn't prayed and they didn't really have the faith. Discipleship is not just about membership in a group. It's about a life lived in the power and guidance of the Spirit. And Jesus says here, even the most insignificant act that is done in my name will be noticed. It might not be noticed by anybody else. It'll be noticed by God. And it'll be noticed by the person to whom it's done. The proverbial cup of cold water kind of thing. In fact, verse 41 is the beginning of a section of Proverbs about discipleship. If you're doing it because of Christ, you won't be forgotten. Now, its phrase will by no means lose his reward. Well, that also begs the attitude, why are we doing it? Well, if we're doing it for Christ, we're not doing it for the reward, but we will be rewarded. If we do it for the reward, not gonna work. So Jesus says we shouldn't do these things so that we can get the accolades, so that we can get paraded around, so that people will look at us and say, boy, I wish I could pray like that. I wish I could do that. No, we do the things, the gifts, the grace gifts that we have, if done in the name of Christ with no expectation that we're going to be put up on a pedestal and have a ticker tape parade. Those are the things that will be noticed by God and by others for whom they're done. And those are the things that will be important in life. Verse 42, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown in the sea. Little ones here, once again, are the disciples. They're the ones that are, in Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, they're the poor in spirit. The dependent. Those who don't think. You know, children who feel helpless and weak. They're constantly trying to, and needy. What are they trying to do? A lot of times they're not only trying to feel like they're protected, but they want to feel like they're important. And they'll do things and say things so that for those accolades, for that response back and forth. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about that you should be the poor in spirit, and the church should show special care for those who seem unimportant, those who are in need, those who seem unattractive to the world. You know, one of the biggest draws, and then somebody didn't even give them straws, they just made them drink the Kool-Aid, of places like and people like Jim Jones and the People's Temple and David Koresh at Camp Koresh outside of Waco. I refer to him as the Wacko from Waco. And those other kinds of things is the biggest draw of cults on people, what we would call cults on people, even those who might have money and position and power, is they make them feel like they're wanted, where they have felt unloved, unwanted, unattractive, other places, even sometimes in the church. And then these people say, well, come on, we'll love you, we'll help you, we'll care for you, give us all your money and all your property, and we'll make sure it's put to good use to help care for you and other people too, and you're doing a great work. And we love you, we love you, we love you. And then you get sucked in. Well, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, comfort food. Because we've had folks. I've had folks to tell me before. Folks at some of these other churches say, "Well, come over here." They say, "Well, I'm doing two or three things over at First Baptist, or I'm doing two or three things over at this church." Well, and I'm getting tired, and it's a drain on my time. Well, come over here. They won't ask you to do anything. Give your money. Yeah. It's kind of like and I guess that's kind of like Led Zeppelin. Stairway to Heaven. There's a lady who's told all that glitters is gold, and she's climbing the stairway to heaven. But the downtrodden, even the indifferent, the weary, and the wearisome. That's where patience comes in, I guess. The wearisome. They wear us out. But he says, the church is to be about trying to gather and educate and build up the faith and care for even those folks, or maybe especially those folks. Then Jesus uses hyperbole. By the way, drowning was one of the most detestable things within Judaism that one could do. Of course, I don't think it's too cool myself is to drown. But what do they do in England? What do we do in this country as a means of figuring out if somebody was a witch or not? You tie them up, throw them in. If they floated, they were a witch, and if they didn't, they weren't. Well, eventually, if you left them in there long enough, they'd float after they drown. but then he gives a series of warnings, and he uses hyperbole here. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. And does he really mean that? No. But, hyperbole. He said, you got to take things seriously. It'd be better to lose a body part because of the continuation of sin. It'd be better to lose that body part than end up in Gehenna, than end up in hell. Cut it off. It is better for you to enter life, and he's talking about the afterlife, maimed than with two hands to go to hell to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. Better for you to enter life lame than with two feet to be thrown into hell. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Now, this is very much like what we find in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. With two eyes than to be thrown into hell where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. By the way, this passage has often been misused. It does not teach that one will be tormented forever in the flames and fire. There are other places in the Bible that talk about that, but this is talking about the unquenchable fire, and you're going to be burned up. The fire is not put out. This is not one of those places, although it's often used to say that you're going to be in there with the worms, and it's used in movies, horror movies. You're going to be in there with the worms that don't ever burn up and that kind of thing. That's not what this passage is about. This passage is a warning about going into the Valley of Hinnom and being burned up, Gehenna, which is based on the Valley of Hinnom where the trash didn't stay there forever. What happened to the trash in the fire? The garbage in the fire? It eventually burned up and was no more, but there was more garbage that was thrown in there. So this particular section has been misused often to say you're going to burn forever, as opposed to you're going to have that in that unquenchable fire and you're going to burn up. And it's going to be horrendous.
What's the point of that? I mean, is God really that man or somebody? Why not just plan on evaporation?
Well, and that's a good question. Why is God really that mad? Why not evaporation, et cetera? Under King Manasseh, the conquering armies who worshiped the god Moloch had built an altar or a statue of Moloch, a metal statue, in the Valley of Hinnom, which is southeast of Jerusalem, where Moloch sometimes demanded human sacrifice, they said, and sometimes pedo sacrifice, child sacrifice. We are told in the text that Manasseh sacrificed one of his sons in that valley. King Manasseh actually sacrificed one of his sons. And they didn't kill the kid and then put him in the arms. They would put the child alive in the arms of the statue that had been heated up. So after Manasseh and after the Jews came out of that occupation, they kept the Valley of Gehinnom became the garbage dump for Jerusalem and surrounding area. Well, the way to get rid of the garbage, the only way they knew to get rid of the garbage was to burn it. And so a fire was constantly burning in the Valley of Hinnom, which then in Greek becomes Gehinnom, or Gehenna, hell, in English. And so as they were thinking about torments, and they couldn't imagine, and of course there were others talking about it too, but the Jews could not, of that time, could not imagine anything that would be more horrible than being burned to death. And so, you got children in here burned to death. Others burned it, so they couldn't think of anything more. It was even worse than drowning, was to be burned to death. And so when they said, what must the punishment be like? Well, it must be like being placed in the fire in Gehinnom, or the Valley of Hinnom, or hell, and burned to death. Not burned slowly forever, but burned to death. So when Jesus is talking here to the disciples, that's their concept. Is being thrown into the, if you don't follow God, you're going to be thrown into this valley and burned up. You just hope it goes quickly, kind of thing. And then thought began developing, there came the understanding before the New Testament was finished that it would be in the lake of fire in Gehenna, not Hades. Hades is a separate place. But in Gehenna, the lake of fire, where one, it would be unquenchable fire, but one would burn forever. So the understanding developed from being burned up to this. But then in the Old Testament, when one, for the end of Psalm 1, the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Well, the word for perish in Hebrew means to become nothing. And so that, so it's an ongoing understanding and developments. It's progressive revelation where we understand some things about God, but then once we get to, I understand all this, we're not done, then we get more. And so it's an ongoing growth. It's a spiritual growth and maturing. It's a maturing of knowledge throughout our lives.
Judge and I were talking one time about what's the point in overkill, like burning forever and everything else. And he said, and I don't know if it's a Catholic belief or not, something about St. Thomas waking up in the morning and turning the spit on Judas all day long. Have you ever heard that story?
No. Well, he may, okay. You're turning on the spit. Thomas, supposedly Thomas went to, the doubter, went to India, and he helped to start churches in India, but then he got involved with one of the Rajahs there in a building project and some other things, and he was eventually burned to death. Yes.
In other words, you talk about Revelation blindness because it's perpetual now, so it's always going into hell for
saved. Now, only God knows for sure. Yeah. And those people that go.
Lord.
For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but salt is all saltiness. How will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. The fire of God purifies. The fire here is the fire of God. That is the fire of God that purifies, that gets rid of all of our impurities. And, says, so everyone will be salted with fire. Everybody will be tested with fire. The salt is good for those who learn from it and are preserved by God. So have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. So have that purity of thought, that purity of connection with God, and be at peace, not only with yourself, but with one another. And it's a minute and a half till. I was going to stop at quarter till, but then...
No.
Starting in chapter 10 in the Gospel of Mark, we have that journey from Galilee down to Jerusalem in preparation to die. We'll pick up there next time in chapter 10. Thank you.